Hello and welcome to Crime Theories Off the Record, the podcast series where I talk about my interpretation of crime theories. This is your host, Karen. Today I will be venturing into Rose and Claire's chorus mobility theory, but before I jump into this, I would like to remind everyone that I am not an expert in every aspect of my field, but I have researched the topic. To recap, we have explored three contemporary perspectives, making this one, the fourth perspective, consistent with labeling theory that we reviewed regarding how the quality of the societal reaction to offenders, including their arrest, sanctioning, and especially imprisonment and stigmatizing social exclusion may have the unanticipated consequence of deepening people's criminality. From the viewpoint of previous scholars such as Sherman and Rose and Clear, the challenge is to find ways to help the adverse criminogenic effects of the sanctions typically imposed. And yes, I am talking about restorative justice and prison reentry programs. However, I won't be discussing those topics in depth just yet. Labeling theory has been primarily a theory of how state punishment has the unanticipated consequence of increasing, if not stabilizing, the criminality of individuals. For today's academic duo, Tina Rose and Todd Clear, 1998, however, elevate the perspective from individuals to the community. Their project is to explore what happens when the government adopts a policy of mass incarceration that disproportionately removes young minority males from inner city. Off the record, I might have already butchered their last names, but Dr. Dina Rose is an assistant professor in the School of Criminology and Criminal Justice at Florida State University. Her PhD in sociology is from Duke University, and she has published work on community disorganization, social control, and juvenile delinquency. Her current research interests include community control, social policy, and homelessness. As for Dr. Todd Clear, he is a professor and associate dean of the School of Criminology and Criminal Justice at Florida State University. His PhD in criminal justice is from the University of Albany, and his publications include Harm in America Penology and Controlling the Offender in the Community. His current research interests include incarceration policy, alternatives to imprisonment, and community justice. Now, Rose and Clear, 1998, point out that it is estimated that nearly 1 in 10 African-American underclass males between the ages of 26 and 30 are currently in prison, and that nearly 3 in 10 black men will spend time in the state or federal prison during their lifetime. These numbers have just gotten worse with time. But they conceptualize this incarceration as a form of coerced mobility, a practice that regularly takes large numbers of males out of inner city communities for prolonged absences. As noted, labeling theory is counterintuitive because it suggests that efforts to achieve social control can backfire in unexpected ways. In this case, Rose and Clear theorize that the mass coerced mobility of minority males may well have the unanticipated consequence of increasing, rather than decreasing, a community's crime rate. This thesis is counterintuitive because it could seem that locking up predatory criminals could make inner city neighborhoods safer. The ULO 1994 has claimed that incarcerating such offenders is, in essence, a form of social justice that could save black lives. Off the record, if you ask me, this ideology is problematic and is rooted in systemic colonialism and racism. And here is why. It is no secret that minorities disproportionately end up in the judicial system or interacting with the system. It's no secret that young black men have it even worse when it comes to being in the system. Throughout the years, discourse accepts minorities' criminality, especially African Americans. That idea and concept that minorities are criminal is mostly because of the language that comes from a legacy of slavery and colonialism, especially regarding Native Americans being vilified. The same argument can be made about other minority groups in regards to colonialism. Rose and Clear, 1998, are not naive to this reality. They realize that it is hard to comprehend how it can be bad for neighborhood life to remove people who are committing crimes in those very neighborhoods. Still, when incarceration is massive and concentrated in vulnerable communities, then it may become a macro level force that undermines existing social institutions in such a way as to produce more rather than less social disorganization and conditions conducive to crime. Theoretically, they are suggesting that incarceration might have a feedback loop that causes disorganization. If so, then their thesis is a notable extension of social disorganization theory, which we have discussed in this podcast in previous episodes, calling attention to an important source of a neighborhood's ability to achieve organization and social control. For Rose and Clear 1998, offenders are community liabilities, such as victimizers, often less than ideal parents. Still, they also are community assets, such as producers of income, supporters of families, parents, and members of social networks. Their incarceration thus lessens liability, as is often recognized, but it also depletes the community of assets, as is often not recognized. The impact on neighborhoods will differ by the area's affluence and existing level of social organization. In stable working class and middle class communities, the incarceration of a limited number of resident offenders is likely a social benefit. But in underclass neighborhoods, the overuse of prisons, high levels of incarceration year after year, risk depleting the area of resources it desperately needs and weakening core social institutions. Incarceration thus has differential impacts depending on its magnitude on the nature of the neighborhood. Now, waxing to my Sherlock, take this for example, the impact of incarceration on family stability. Offenders typically earn money legally and illegally, and although not always reliable providers, are a source of income for their partners and children or just family in general. When they are incarcerated, family life is often disrupted, which contributes to social disorganization. Lacking income, families frequently change addresses, move into different school districts, and go on public assistance. Obviously, this is not always the case, but parents have less time to supervise their children. A new partner, not the children's parents, may enter the household, creating more instability. On a broader level, the chorus mobility of offenders to prison means that a substantial portion of the community's male population spends years out of the labor market and builds little human capital. Their job prospects upon re-entry are limited. As a result, the marriage pool of people in the area consisting of ex-prisoners with few marketable skills is unattractive, leading people to forgo marriage but not necessarily the concept of parenting. A high concentration of single-headed households thus prevails, a condition that fosters social disorganization and crime. After the chorus mobility of prison, the offenders tend to return to their neighborhoods more of a liability than when they left. And to just put the cherry on top, because it is so common among young males in the area, being sent to prison might lose its stigma. The legitimacy of the government, especially the criminal justice system, is thus called into question. Again, these countervailing forces, all nourished by mass imprisonment, weaken convention institutions, and it obviously has gotten worse as times progress. Rose and Clear does offer a potentially important advance of labeling theory, exploring how formal control can produce crime by undermining informal control. They argue that state social controls, typically directed at individual behavior, have significant secondary effects on family and neighborhood structures. This, in turn, impede the neighborhood's capacity for social control. Thus, at the ecological level, the side effects of policies intended to fight crime by controlling individual criminals may exacerbate problems that lead to crime in the first place. So far, empirical research on their theory of chorus mobility is in short supply and has yielded supportive but inconsistent results. The most formidable challenge to the theory is research showing that, due mostly to the effects of incapacitation, incarceration is inversely related to crime. These findings, however, may be misleading. They do not show, for example, whether greater crime savings might be achieved if money devoted to mass imprisonment was to be allocated to criminal justice sanctions that are more community-based focused and strategically oriented to building human capital in offenders. Additionally, although imprisonment might achieve coexisting or short-term reductions in crime rates, this does not mean that its overuse might not still be a factor in worsening levels of social disorganization and contributing to the emergence of the next generation of offenders. Thank you for listening and choosing this podcast. This episode is brought to you by Anchor. Please rate, review, and subscribe on Spotify or whatever platform you're listening from. And don't forget to tune in for the next episode. Off the record, if you need help visualizing these theories, go check us up on Instagram at ct.offtherecord.